Okay, so thank you for the invitation to the seminar. And today I'm going to talk about the story in this paper. So here the goal is to construct some example that realize gravity as an emergent phenomena. So after some short introduction, I will discuss the kinematic structure and dynamics of the model that I am considering, and then discuss potential implication of the existence of some concrete Hamiltonian that from which GR emerges in the long distance limit for the problem of time and the black hole information puzzle. So in the ABS-CFT correspondence, suppose I want to understand the emergence of the bulk from field theory point of view. Then, we start with a field theory defined in this space and time, and we consider some generating functional for the field theory defined on some fixed but generally curved space-time background metric. And this generating functional is a functional of that fixed metric. Okay. And then what one can do is to apply some coarse graining to this field theory. And then as you coarse grain, of course, this metric that couples to the low energy degrees freedom, after you integrate at the high energy degree freedom, the metric seen by the low energy degree freedom will be modified. And furthermore, in general, you generate some nonlinear operator of the energy momentum tensor, for example, those so-called multi-trace operators of the energy momentum tensor can be incorporated by allowing this metric that couples to the energy momentum tensor to be fluctuating degree freedom. So at some length scale, the same partition function, the same generating functional is given by some of the metric that whose fluctuation encodes the information about the multi-trace operator for the energy momentum tensor, and this thing determines the position of the peak and also the shape, which determines the multi-trace operator generated from coarse graining. So in this sense, the bulk theory can be viewed as a theory that generates the quantum linearization group, where it's kind of coarse result of coarse graining, but it's quantum in the sense that the source, in this case the metric, become dynamical. By the way, please stop me at any time if there's anything unclear. And then, of course, in this case, the diffeomorphism invariance is broken by the presence of the boundary at which the metric is fixed. But the theory itself in the bulk is supposed to be background independent and doesn't prism a particular background. So what one can show is to apply some linearization group procedure to your field theory, and then you generate not only the single trace operator but multi-trace operator, and then the usual Riesenian RG flow is defined in the space of all multi-trace operator, But now the statement is that you can now project this RG flow within the subspace of single trace operator. If you just do that, you ignore the contribution of multi-trace operator, but you can keep those information by allowing the single trace source to be fluctuating. And then the pattern of fluctuation, the wave function for the single trace source captures precisely what kind of multi-trace operators you have. Okay, so that you can show. And then from that you can show in this procedure, this generating functional is given by sum of RG paths defined in the space of single trace sources. And in particular, the metric becomes dynamical because you have to sum over all RG paths. And then there's an action that determines the weight for RG paths within the single trace space. This is what you can show, okay? And that action in the bulk generally is a theory for dynamical gravity, okay? Because you have to sum over a metric that couples to the energy momentum tensor of your field theory.
Can I just understand what's written here? There's on the top line, there's an S, which is at this.
At this, yes. Yes.
And it also says S.
Yeah.
Are those supposed to be the same actions in some sense?
So what I implicitly did here is to integrate out the short distance mode, right? So therefore, this theory has, say, effectively less degrees freedom. But after rescaling of your space and time, your action takes the same form as this one. In the usual RG sense.
Well, let's see. In the usual RG sense, the action takes the same form?
Yeah, it's the same action. You can.
I'm confused. If I do an exact RG transformation, I really integrate out all the short distance phenomena. Don't I generally turn a local action into a non-local action? In what sense is it the same form?
Sorry, so
you imagine you're including all possible operators.
That's right. I'm including all possible operators.
Okay, so the form of S even originally is so
broad, yes,
that the action could be considered non-local.
That's right. But you can turn off most of the operators initially. Yeah.
Okay, right.
So, but here I'm just schematically keeping only the source for the energy momentum tensor. But in general there are other sources. So here I'm keeping track of only the energy momentum, the source for the energy momentum tensor, but there are other sources, as you mentioned. The most general action includes source for most general operators you can turn on within the theory.
Right. So when you say that's all you're keeping track of, you mean that's all you explicitly wrote down, or you have some...
No, this is just a schematic.
Okay.
Yeah. Just to give an idea. This one, yes. For a given RG scheme, this is something you can compute, you can calculate. If you have a regularization for your field theory, and if you define the RG scheme, then this is something you can compute. Okay. And then the claim is that this is kind of a propagator from the boundary source to wave function of the source at the slice inside the bulk. And this propagation in the bulk is what the bulk gravitational theory describes in this sense. Okay.
Wouldn't you have thought that the S would also depend on Z?
This S does not depend on Z explicitly. It depends Z only through Z-dependent wave function here. Okay, and however, this ABS-CFT does not directly apply to our universe because we are living in a digital space, and there have been efforts to understand correspondence between gravity and distal space with some boundary non-unitary conformal field theory defined on some spatial slice through the guidance from ADS-CFT correspondence. And the purpose of today's talk is to try to take a more microscopic approach and come up with some concrete model which realizes the emergent gravity and time. Okay, so more concretely, I start with a spatial manifold. Okay, let's forget about this for now. And in the previous case, the fundamental object is the action defined on a space-time slice. But I don't have time, I just have space. So therefore, I consider a state, okay? And this state, just as this action, depends on the background metric here. This is the space-time metric. Now I consider a state for some quantum matter that depends on a space metric. Okay, so my states are now parameterized by space metric. Okay. And then instead of considering coarse graining, I want to consider a unitary time evolution for the metal field. And I want to construct the Hamiltonian such that this time evolution generate at this later time another state which can be written as a linear superposition of these states. Okay? And therefore, state that I obtain here at later time, say, is given by some linear superposition of these states, which are parameterized by this metric, but now this metric is dynamical in the sense that I have to do linear superposition, and this determines the weight for each state with different metric. Okay, so that's the rough picture. And the question that I'm going to address is whether there is a Hamiltonian for the metal field that in which this evolution of this wave function coincides with the general relativity in the classical limit and long distance scale. Okay, that's the first question. And if so, what are the properties of those Hamiltonians? And then what does this imply? What does the existence of such Hamiltonian can potentially imply for the problem of time in quantum gravity and then the information puzzle?
Are you presuming some slicing?
T is some parameter time. So here I'm assuming some fixed gauge. So I'm cutting this slice in some way by fixing the lapse.
Is it a radius
of
ADS-CFT or something?
So
is it radius or actual time?
Oh, this T. Yeah. So this is supposed to be time.
Okay.
Right. Doesn't have to be expanding, but I'm thinking of the expanding universe, but can go down as well. So it depends on the, I think, initial condition of this state.
So does that mean G hat is sometimes set up one solution, which is not fluctuational at all?
So this G hat is a fixed metric.
Yeah.
Okay. And this G is the fluctuating metric, which determines, and then this psi is a wave function for the metric, which determines the weight of the this state at this time, which is given by linear superposition of state with different metric. Okay.
And that wave function depends on T now.
Yes, yeah, okay, sorry, this is supposed to be T, yeah. So,
self-adjoint operators in space, are they something else?
Yeah, it is some self-joint operator. And here, especially, I want to know how local or non-local this Hamiltonian is.
Is it correct to think of G hat here just as a label for the state?
Yes, yes.
Psi of phi is the wave function for the state.
For the meta field.
For the meta field. Yeah. And what you're writing down is the time-evolved state is a superposition of the state initially for different parameter of G hat.
Yes. So suppose you start with a state with definite value of g, and then if you time evolve, in generally you end up having a state that is made of superposition of state that have different g, right? Okay. And this guy determines the wave function defined in the space of metric, space of space metric. This psi is same as this psi.
It's the same as the one on the left.
Yeah, this is same as on the left. Sorry. I'm wrong. This is state defined on this slice. This is the initial state. But the form of psi is same. So this is. Yeah, this is a bad notation. This is the state defined on this slice, which is in general different from this state. So this is the, this is not a right notation. This is the state defined on this slice.
Okay, and I also play, but there are two sides in your equation.
This side is same as this side.
That side is the same as on the left.
This one.
Okay, but there's also a side on the left side of the equation.
This one. No, please ignore this. This is a different, I should have used different notation. Yeah. So this is the state wave function at this late time.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Right, yeah. Okay, yeah, sorry.
So this really just says the state at the late time is some integral kernel acting on the state of the
Yeah.
Okay. Which, if there's an operator of that form, it will certainly, you can write it in this way.
Yes, right. This is very general statement. Yeah.
If you start with a completely non-settled state initially, then yes. Then any final state can be
Right.
But
so
I guess this is for this part of my question. This is psi is a fixed state, so it's a fixed function of little phi and g hat.
Yes. So this is a wave function for phi. So phi is not integrated over here.
Oh, it's only a wave function for phi.
Right.
Do
you have this kind of variational parameters of the wave function? They are parameters of the wave function. Yeah, maybe this picture will become more clear when I actually discuss the.
I see. So h hat as an operator is supposed to act only on the phi argument.
Here I'm just so this is the matter field, right? This g hat is just the parameter in the wave function for the matter field. Okay. Okay. So
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
You really mean that you don't need to also integrate over the phi? The phi.
Phi is not integrative because this is wave function, right? For phi.
And it's the same phi that appears in the wave function on the left is on the right.
This phi.
Yeah.
So let's say this is psi prime of phi. This is the wave function for phi defined at time t.
So the wave function at time t evaluated on matter configuration.
Yes.
No, I don't even know what this means.
Wave function is function of phi, right?
Right.
And you at time t.
That at time t, that will only depend on the initial wave function evaluated on the same matter configuration phi, but perhaps for different metrics. metrics. And I realized I don't know what it means to keep phi the same and change the metric.
Sorry. Say view this as a for a fixed G,
yeah.
View this as a vector in the Hilbert space of phi.
Yeah.
Right? And this is just a linear proportion of those vectors.
No, because you're not integrating over phi.
Yeah, so it's a vector. So for a given phi, that evaluates particular component of the vector. In the phi, right?
Now, are you saying that if I consider two different g's, those will be the same Hilbert space?
Yeah, but different vectors, but in the same Hilbert space.
In what sense do I live in the same Hilbert space?
In the metrics,
that I need some diffeomorphism to identify the points of one with another.
Okay.
I don't even know what it means for matter fields in the same configuration. I wouldn't know how to.
So here I'm just considering the ordinary matter field defined on a manifold. And here, metric is just a parameter in this wave function for the metric field.
But if we're talking about a Hilbert space, the Hilbert space has an inner product.
Right.
In this suggests you're using some kind of Schrodinger inner product, L2 integration.
So inner product is given by inner product of the ordinary metric field. So that.
But doesn't that implicitly depend on the metric?
Yeah. So you need to define some fiduciary metric here. So that's different from this metric here.
Yeah,
that determines the inner product.
Okay.
And then this one is just a parameter of the wave function for the.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Okay.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So the. Plan is that, so in the case of ADS-CFT, where this extra direction is the space-like direction, what is defined at the boundary is the unitary CFT parameterized by space-time metric, right? Then instead of this, in this case, I want to start with a quantum state defined on space manifold, and these states are parameterized by space metric. And then in this case, the bulk evolution is generated by some coarse graining procedure. And here I want to consider some unitary evolution generated by Hermitian operator. Okay? And then at some later scale or time, what you have is the wave function for the space-time metric here. And here you have a wave function for space metric.
Sorry, let me just understand. If you're fixing a fiducial metric,
yes.
Then should I understand since this will give you a sum over geometries, but every slice has a fixed topology. There's no sum over topologies in this problem.
Yeah, here is a fixed topology.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so.
There's no matter field in your sum.
In this here?
Yeah. Over here.
Yeah. Yeah, this is beside the wave function for the metric, which determines the weight for different state.
Phi is on the two sides.
This phi is.
They don't depend on time at all.
This phi? No.
Over here.
This is say psi prime, the wave function defined at time t.
Different time.
Yeah. So this depends on time t. Yeah, this wave function depends on time t. And therefore, this guy depends on time t here. So this is type. Yeah.
And I'm sorry, I'm still a little confused. Maybe you'll see this later. H is something that knows about the fiducial metric, which is not g hat, I suppose. Is H allowed to depend on g hat, or is H required to be independent of g hat?
It can depend on g hat, the fiduciary metric.
So, wait, I thought there's another fiduciary metric as well. Right?
So this is not what I call fiduciary metric. This is the initial metric, right? And fiduciary metric is some metric that I need to define the inner product.
Right.
Okay.
So H depends on the
Right.
But not on G hat.
No. So yeah, this is yeah. It doesn't depend on G hat.
It's not.
Yeah.
Okay.
So user linear operator.
And in terms of the rules, you say that we want to start with this initial state, which is a state for each G hat. Are we allowed to choose those initial states however we want? Or is the idea that the initial state for one G hat is somehow related to the initial state for a different G hat? Or can I choose them to be completely independent?
So there are different vectors in the Hilbert space.
Right, but are they arbitrary or are there rules that relate them?
So the relation can be probably quantified by inner product.
Sure.
Right, and then so you can ask how big the difference in G hash should be in order for two state with different metric to be orthogonal.
My question is, do you want this to hold for all possible choices of the initial
state? Yes, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that means all possible choices where I'm allowed to choose the initial state independently for each G hat.
Yes.
I could choose the state to be a delta function in some configuration for one G hat and delta function in a different configuration for a different G hat.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I
could have chosen some general linear superposition of this state.
Okay, but I guess I'm confused because I could also choose psi to be independent of G hat. I could just make that choice.
Oh, so I'm considering a particular subset in the full Hilbert space,
yeah,
which are parameterized by G hat. So those are my Hilbert space that I'm considering. So it's like you consider only specific set of theory in the ADS-CFT. In the full theory of space of theories, I can consider specific CFT, right? That depends on G in a particular way. Likewise, here I'm considering a sub-Hilbert space, which depends on G hat in a very particular way.
You're considering particular G hat dependent states in the Hilbert space, which depend on G hat in a particular way.
Yes, right.
Okay.
So I'll make it more explicit, you know, later.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So this is the plan. Okay. So the starting point is that I start with a space manifold with a fixed topology, say, three torus. Okay. Then on this manifold, I consider a matrix valued meta field. So A, B run from 1 to N, and say this is Hermitian matrix field. And then the full Hilbert space is spanned by this basis vector, which is just the eigenvector for this fundamental field operator. Okay. So this is the full Hilbert space. Now, within this full Hilbert space, I'm considering a specific sub-Hilbert space, okay? And this sub-Hilbert space is spanned by state which are parameterized by singlet collective variables. So singlet under the UN or SUN rotation, okay? And in particular, in this talk, I'm going to consider two collective variables. One is triad and the other is scalar field. So triad is the just the square of that gives the positive definite space metric. Okay. So my state in the sub-Hilbert space spanned by these vectors, okay, which are labeled by triad and one scalar field. Okay. And then these states are given by, of course, the linear superposition of this basis vector in the full Hilbert space. And this is the wave function for the meta field for given triad and scalar field, okay? And this wave function, I choose to be a Gaussian wave function, okay? So here it's like action form, but it's not action, it's just wave function where it's a quadratic in phi, it's a Gaussian. And then this corner, kr, is just a Laplacian operator, del square, defined with this metric constructed from the triad, okay? And then the sigma, this scalar field, enters as a mass term in the unit of some length scale, LC. And then this heat corner is just to regularize this to the Laplacian. Okay, so when the eigenvalue of this Laplacian operator is smaller than the inverse of this length scale, then this is just this Laplacian. On the other hand, when the eigenvalue is much larger than the inverse of this, then it becomes one. Okay, so there's some smooth cutoff structure here. So that is just a regularized Laplacian operator. And then this thing that is independent of this fundamental field is chosen to be this state is normalized. Okay, this is a normalization factor. Okay, so this is my state. And then regarding to your question, in order to properly define this this measure for the functional integration, you have to have some fiduciary metric. That is this E hat and sigma hat. So this is defined to be the integration over the eigenmode, which is defined in terms of this Laplacian operator with some fixed triad and fixed scalar field. Okay, so the fiduciary metric is in this measure. Okay, so this is how I introduce the metric and this scalar field. They are just some variational parameters for the wave function of my metal field. Okay, and what are the meaning of this variational parameter, the collective variable? So this metric, space metric, is the variable that sets the notion of locality in how the metal fields are entangled in space, and also it determines the number of degrees of freedom that are entangled in space. Okay, so in order to see that, suppose I compute the von Neumann entanglement entropy of this state, okay, for some fixed triad and scalar field for a region A in the space. Then you can compute that to the leading order, the entropy is proportional to the area of this boundary, which is evaluated with this metric. So proportional to the proper area evaluated with this metric. Okay? So meaning that for a given region, if you have a state with different metric, then the proper area is different. Therefore, the entanglement is different. Yes.
States,
yes.
Which are vacuum-like. And you don't expect the state to be vacuum-like if you're doing cosmology. You expect it to be thermal and to have some entropy that goes like volume and
other. Right, yeah. Yeah, this is very particular state. More general state will be given by linear superposition of this state, this basis state. So here I'm considering only short-range entangled state. But the sense of locality is controlled by this metric. Okay.
Why doesn't your fiducial measure show up in your fiducial metric show up in this one or in the field?
It doesn't show up.
Why?
So there is a fiduciary metric here, but also this normalization condition also depends on fiduciary metric in such a way that inner product between two states within this subhilbert space does not depend on fiduciary metric. Yeah. So this is something you can prove explicitly.
And you're going to tell us why you need the scalar field? So far, it doesn't seem necessary, right?
Right. So then scalar field controls the range of mutual information. So if you measure the mutual information between point X and Y for this state with fixed collective variable, then the mutual information decays exponentially in the proper distance, again measured with that that metric in the state. And also the rate of the decay is controlled by this scalar field. Okay. So these are the physical meaning of those collective variables. Okay. And I'm considering sub-Hilbert space spanned by these vectors. So that's the kinematic setup. And in general, so here is the point. So one can also, so inner product, between this basis vector also depends on this fiduciary metric. However, due to this normalization factor, which again depends on the fiduciary metric, the inner product between two states does not depend on fiduciary metric. Furthermore, because of that, this inner product is invariant under spatial diffeomorphism. In other words, so inner product between two states with two collective variables is same as the inner product with different two states which are related to this through the same diffeomorphism, spatial diffeomorphism. And also, if you have two states where the proper volume is different, if there's any region in space where local proper volume is different, then those two states are orthogonal. Okay? And this is due to the fact that the Hilbert space is infinite. So this is defined on the continuum. So if you have different proper volume, you effectively, the number of degrees of freedom do not match. And as a result, they are orthogonal for any n, actually. And then, if n is the number of n by n matrix, large, number of metafields. And square is the number of metafields. And then if you have two states with the same local proper volume, then you can still have different metric and collect the scalar field. Then overlap doesn't vanish in general. However, the overlap decays exponentially in the difference between the collective variable, between this and this, where the decay rate is proportional to n squared. So if n is large, then essentially any two states with different collective variables are orthogonal. Okay, if collective variables differ more than 1 over n, then those two states are almost orthogonal. Okay. And then the most general state within this sub-Hilbert space V is given by linear superposition of those states. Okay, and this chi is now some wave function defined in the space of triad and the scalar field, okay? And then I define the measure for this collective variable from this condition. So as I said, this overlap is sharply peaked at when E prime is E in the large limit. And then I determine the measure such that this integration is one. Essentially, the physical meaning is that I assign the measure in the space of collective variable so that each orthogonal state assume take the volume one. That's the meaning of this thing.
But the scene is a collective mode of the matter?
Yes, both triad and sigma are some singlet collective mode of the metafield.
So how do they get defined as a matter?
So they are defined through this wave function. So this is the wave function for the matter. And if you change the collective variable sigma or metric, then your wave function for the matter changes. So this metric and sigma describe particular, deformation of the state in the matter field.
Okay.
Yeah, S0 is something you can write down explicitly in terms of trace of this corner, which is determined from this condition that your state is normalized. So, yeah. Yes. So in G, G of E and sigma. Yeah. And this has to be because there are n square degrees of freedom, so that there are large number of fields define the same background field. So if the background field differ a little bit, if n is very large, then they are orthogonal. And then one can think about semi-classical state. By semi-classical state, I mean the state where this wave function for the collective variable is sharply peaked as some classical metric and the collective variable. And you can have some fast oscillation within, it's a basically wave packet that has a well-defined position and momentum. So one can think about some semi-classical state. And then you can also, you can say, then the entanglement entropy, von Neumann entanglement entropy over given region for this kind of state is not just given by area law, because now this wave, there is a non-trivial wave function for the collective variable. And for the semi-classical state, the entanglement entropy of region A can be separated into two contributions. The first is what I call color entanglement entropy. This is the entanglement entropy of n square matter degrees freedom defined on a fixed metric. So in this case, it obeys the area law, and this area is measured with this the classical metric here. Okay, so that is the color entanglement entropy. But in this case, because the wave function, because this chi, the wave function for the collective variable has a non-trivial fluctuation, there's an additional contribution. This is generated by correlation in the fluctuation of the collective variable. Okay, and they are order of one, because they are only order of one collective variables. However, this is not necessarily smaller than this, because this can obey the volume law. If the fluctuation is for the collective variable is large, and if they have long range correlation, then this can be volume law. Okay, so in that sense, the general state given by linear superposition can describe state that have a volume law entanglement entropy. Okay. So now, so far this is I have defined the states and inner products and the properties of those states. And now I want to consider operator that acts on this space. In particular, I'm interested in the operators which map this sub-Hilbert space into the sub-Hilbert space. So if I apply this operator to any state within this sub-Hilbert space, the resulting state still is defined within this sub-Hilbert space. So I think I didn't explain this picture. Maybe it was obvious, but this picture is supposed to imply this this wave function. So these thin lines are the physical variable, the matter field. And the thick lines are collective variable. So this object wave function depends both on the matter field and the collective variable. But if I fix the collective variable here, then it is the wave function for the matter field. Okay, this is just a tensor. And then most general wave function is given by contracting this collective variable with some wave function for the collective variable here. This is just a pictorial representation. And now I want to have an operator that acts on this general state. And then that resulting state still lives in this subhilbert space. Therefore, for those operator, it can be still written as a linear superposition of those state, right? And therefore, that operator can be understood as an operator acting on the collective variable. Okay, this is just a general statement. And one of those operator is the momentum operator, okay? So this is the usual operator that generate the local diffeomorphism for the matter field defined on the space manifold. Then if you apply this local diffeomorphism operator to this general state, and then you can show that the resulting state is again given by linear superposition of those state with the wave function now, which is acted upon by this differential operator, which is nothing but the translation, local translation generator for the collective variable. Okay, so in this sense, this momentum operator is an operator that satisfies this condition. And now, I want to find a Hamiltonian density operator, okay? I want to find Hamiltonian density operator that satisfies this condition, okay? And furthermore, I want to have a Hamiltonian density operator which acts on this state in such a way that resulting state is given by the wave function which is acted upon by Wheeler-DeWitt Hamiltonian, okay? Where this is a differential operator for the collective variable, E and derivative of the collective variable. I'm point splitting this differential operator in some regularization scheme, and I'm using some particular ordering for the operator. But these issues are not important in the Lagrangian limit. But my question is that, is there a Hamiltonian for the matter field whose action on this state coincide with a Wheeler-DeWitt Hamiltonian for the collective variable? Okay. And the answer is yes. You can reverse engineer from this situation and find the operator for the matter field which satisfies this condition. Such Hamiltonian is very ugly. In terms of the original matter field, but the statement is there exists a Hamiltonian for the matter field which induces the Wheeler-DeWitt Hamiltonian for the collective variable. Okay. Let me just. Yes. Yeah. There are in general higher derivative and higher order terms that are suppressed by this length scale S, and I cannot avoid this. Right. Okay, so let me just explain some properties that this Hamiltonian satisfy, okay? So this Hamiltonian has a very interesting structure. So it has the following structure. So first, so this is the Hamiltonian density that has the previous property. So first, let's look at this piece. So this is a Hamiltonian, some Hermitian operator for the matter field, Hamiltonian density at position x, which depends on this metric and this scalar field, okay? And this Hamiltonian density has the following term, among other things. In particular, it has the double trace of operator for the energy momentum tensor. Here I define the energy momentum tensor to be the derivative of the my logarithm of the wave function with respect to this metric. So in other words, so this is the wave function, but if I interpret this as an action, right, then you can define the energy momentum tensor associated with this action, right? So that is this T mu I, this operator. And then in this Hamiltonian density at position x is given by this operator, which is spread it over distance scale LC. So here, this corner, which is function of y1 and y2, decays exponentially as the distance from y1 to x, or y2 to x, increases. When that distance scale is measured with respect to this metric, GE. So this Hamiltonian is a local Hamiltonian, but local for this metric. Okay, that is the first this piece. Okay, but then we of course know that any Hamiltonian that has a fixed background metric cannot give rise to GR, because GR is supposed to be background independent. So therefore, the real full Hamiltonian that has this property is given by sum of this Hamiltonian over all possible triad and the scalar field. And before you that, you have a projection operator here. So this operator project your general state to a state with definite metric and scalar field. Okay. Of course, for finite n, there's an uncertainty in projection because state with different metric are not completely orthogonal. So there's some fuzzy factor in this projection operator. But the way you think is that if you have a state, then first this operator project your state to a particular state with a metric and collective variable. And then you apply local operator, where is this local Hamiltonian that is local with respect to that metric E. But you don't do it just for one metric, you do it for all possible metric. Okay, that is the structure. So in other words, suppose my wave function is given by linear superposition of those state. Okay, so this is the wave function, and this is supposed to represent this space of collective variable. And suppose this chi has some width, okay? And my wave function has some component with one metric and another component with another metric, okay? And then when I apply this Hamiltonian here, what it does is that for this component, for fixed E1 and sigma 1, you apply Hamiltonian associated with this metric G1 and sigma 1. And for this state with G2 and sigma 2, you apply local Hamiltonian with different metric. Okay? And then this local Hamiltonian, these Hamiltonians are local, but there's no absolute sense of locality, because the distance between the two points is measured with the metric, and the metric is being read from the state. So if you apply this Hamiltonian to a state, right, then first this projection operator read the metric in the state. Then now you apply the local operator defined with the metric. Okay, so in this sense, the notion of locality in this Hamiltonian is defined only relative to the state to which the Hamiltonian acts.
I understand. If the Hamiltonian is really local, is it exactly local, or is it local just up to, again, terms of cutoff scale?
Yeah, terms with cutoff scale, I see.
And the point is that the cutoff scale is being, its cutoff scale is proper distance defined by the metric.
Yes.
E that comes out.
Yes, that's right.
So that's really
interesting. That's right, yeah.
Consider in the limit where the cutoff is taken arbitrarily short, it becomes local and metric independent. Size of the corrections, the amount of non-locality is stated.
Yes, right, yeah, yeah. So this full Hamiltonian is non-local Hamiltonian because it involves, as an operator with arbitrary spread, okay? But, right, that's so. But there is still a weak sense of locality in this Hamiltonian, in the sense that if this Hamiltonian is applied to a state which has small entanglement, such that the proper distance between two points is large, then the strength of the interaction is weak. So that's the next point. So suppose I pick 2 points in the manifold, okay? And I want to know the strength of the coupling between the 2 points. And then the statement is the strength of the coupling depends on the state, okay? If you have a state where you have large entanglement between these 2 points, and therefore the proper distance between 2 points is small, right? Then in that state, the Hamiltonian has a large coupling between these 2 points, because this operator is spread over the distance across this point. Whereas if your state has a very small entanglement between these 2 points, and therefore the proper distance is very large, then in that case, the spread of this operator cannot reach the other point. Therefore, the interaction between these 2 points is negligible.
So this seems like an important point to understand. So again, the thing that is sensitive to whether or not these are entangled is what again? And how does that determine the strength of the interaction?
So this Hamiltonian here, has a coupling between, say, y1 and y2.
Good.
And then the strength of the coupling between y1 and y2 is determined by the proper distance between the 2 points, where the proper distance is measured with this metric.
Okay. Well, okay.
Okay. And then...
Let's just fix that proper distance and then ask the question...
No, proper distance cannot be fixed, right? Because proper distance is property of state.
And you say that, so that's what's changing when you change the entanglement.
Right, that's right. So state with different metric are state with different amount of entanglement, okay?
That in general is true, but going the other way is the thing that seems a little more novel.
So I guess I intend to illustrate a point through this thing. So here, the mutual information between the 2 points is exponentially decaying with respect to the proper distance measured with the metric in this state.
Yeah, in certain states that's true, but I could consider another state where they're very far apart but entangled, you know, like an EPR pair.
Yeah, okay, so...
So that's an illustration of the fact that the arrow goes one way but not the other.
So at least in this, so maybe the one way to say that I constructed this Hilbert space such that it is true in both ways. So in this Hilbert space, the amount of entanglement is reflected in the metric that parameterizes the states. But maybe it is not true for state outside this Hilbert space. For general state, there may be even no notion of locality error in your state.
I think you've actually defined, as you say, you've written a certain class of states and labeled them by triads or metrics in a certain way.
Right.
And in effect, you've defined the labels so that if there's a state in this Hilbert space where 2 points have large entanglement, then that state has at least a large component on a state with a metric distance between the two proper distances should.
That's right. Yeah.
So in effect, the metric has been defined so that strong entanglement means the points are close together.
Yes, right. Yeah, that's right. So in that sense, this Hamiltonian is non-local Hamiltonian, but is relatively local Hamiltonian. There is a sense of locality that you can define for a particular set of states. Okay. Yeah. So this is the point. One can consider the time evolution of some state, Okay, so here this H hat is the Hamiltonian density for the metal field, and I've chosen certain lapse function that depends on space and time, and I time evolve. And then this time evolution is same as time evolution operator that is applied to the wave function for the collective variable. Now this H tilde is the Wheeler-DeWitt Hamiltonian density operator, the differential operator, okay? So this way, one can describe the time evolution of the metric in terms of the time evolution of this matter state. So what is actually evolving is the quantum state of the matter, but those quantum states are labeled by the metric, therefore you can understand that evolution in terms of time evolution of the wave function for the metric. And in general, by choosing this, so here I'm choosing the shift to be zero. I don't have any momentum operator here, and I have chosen particular lapse.
Oh, I see. The states are not gauge fixed in the sense that they're still. I agree with that statement.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm not sure. Are you then going to require though that the states actually satisfy the constraints?
No. That's the next point. So the point is that states that satisfy Hamiltonian or momentum constraints are in general extended in the space of the collective variable. And for those states, in general, the norm is infinite, the norm defined by the norm of the metal field. Okay, so in that sense, those states are not physical states in the Hilbert space of the metal field, right? So, and then, what are the physical state? And most physical state that have finite norm do not satisfy the Hamiltonian constraint or momentum constraint. And in that sense, I view it as a spontaneous symmetry breaking. The state breaks the symmetry, Hamiltonian constraint. And therefore, the time evolution can be viewed as a Goldstone mode associated with that spontaneous symmetry breaking. So in a sense, the initial condition of your initial state breaks the constraint spontaneously. And therefore, the subsequent time evolution kind of follows the, try to restore the symmetry, follow the trajectory of this extended orbit in a sense. Okay? And I think this is very similar to what happens in ADS-CFT as well. So the boundary field theory usually specifies some fixed metric or collective variable, and those boundary states are not annihilated by the operator that generate the evolution in the bulk. And because of that, you have non-trivial evolution. Okay, so in the same sense, even in the time evolution sense, there is a non-trivial time evolution because the initial state breaks the constraint spontaneously. And however, there exists a normalizable and semi-classical state that satisfy the Hamiltonian constraint to the leading order in N. For example, you can consider the wave function for the collective variable, which is centered as some semi-classical metric and with some momentum, the oscillation. So you can choose this conjugate momentum in your wave packet, and the values at which your metric is centered. And then you can choose this classical conjugate momentum and the metric such that they satisfy the Hamiltonian and momentum constraints. So these are the normalizable state which satisfy this Hamiltonian constraint. So in the full Hamiltonian, this is the n squared leading order term. And there are order of one term. The statement is that these states satisfy the Hamiltonian constraint only to the leading order in N. But at the subleading term, they don't satisfy the Hamiltonian constraint. And this weak spontaneous symmetry breaking is is what allows this state to evolve as a function of time when this time evolution operator is applied. Okay, so now we can choose our.
I'm sorry, let me just understand. So if you had a clock, this is like closed cosmology, you're talking about evolving a metric on a torus, say. And so if we had an actual solution of Einstein's equation, I guess coupled to a scalar field, if that's the equation you have.
Right.
For a closed universe, we could pick a time slice, look at the metric and scalar field on that actual solving the constraints. And pick a Gaussian peaked on that. But you say under evolution, it's not going to stay close to the classical evolution?
In the large end limit, it will stay, the saddle point will still dominate in the large end limit because the action is order of n squared for this the collective ALS. So in the usual. Yeah, so if you prepare your initial state to be semi-classical state, and then you're in the, if your Planck constant is very small in the large limit, then the later time state remains semi-classical. I guess unless the time is much larger than, I don't know. Yeah. Yeah.
In deleting one of the classical expansion, it satisfies that quantum constraint.
Right.
But we know it's not equally distributed along the constraint.
Yeah,
surface,
right.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's right.
So,
yeah. And now we can choose our initial state to be a semi-classical state that describes spherically symmetric collapsing mass shell. Okay, so. And then in the larger limit, this evolution will be dominated by the saddle point solution of the Einstein equation coupled to the scalar field. And the semi-classical solution will describe a black hole formation. Okay. And suppose we have chosen the initial condition such that the black hole size is much larger than the cutoff scale as C. And then right after the black hole is formed, if you look at the entanglement between across the horizon, then there is this order of n square color entanglement entropy, as I mentioned before. And also there is some singlet entanglement entropy, but this is negligible compared to this because the fluctuation of the collective variable is not large. Furthermore, the interior of the black hole is still small. And when black hole is just formed, okay? So most of the entanglement entropy is in this color sector. Okay, so this is in the large limit. Now, if you include the 1 over n correction, now this 1 over n correction is described by some effective field theory, which is local theory at length scale, this at scale larger than this cutoff scale. And then this effective field theory will describe the Hawking radiation. And because those collective variables are the one which are described by this weakly coupled effective field theory, the Hawking radiation is only order of one, not n square. Although there are n square metal degrees freedom, the full the Hamiltonian for this n square metal fields are very strongly coupled and complicated, and we don't have control. But in terms of collective variable, this evolution is described by semi-classical effective field theory, which predict there is order of one Hawking radiation. Okay? And this Hawking radiation is emitted in the form of the fluctuation of this singlet collective variable. Okay? And in this sense, the black hole evaporation can be viewed as a process where entanglement is transferred from color sector to the singlet sector. So as black hole evaporate, the horizon shrink, and therefore the color entanglement entropy decreases monotonically. On the other hand, the singlet entanglement entropy increase. And then suppose we time evolve and push the time evolution up to the point where the our so the effective field theory description is still valid, right? So then we choose some time slice here where the size of the horizon is order of this cutoff scale LC. And up to this point, we can trust this effective field theory description, okay? And then at this time slice, you know, the color entanglement entropy is very small. It's negligible compared to the entanglement carried by the Hawking radiation, okay? And then the question is which carries this entanglement with Hawking radiation? And clearly it cannot be this color degrees freedom. And then the point is that in this picture, it is the singlet degrees freedom inside the horizon. And then the question is if there is enough field theory mode inside the horizon that can account for the entanglement with the early Hawking radiation. Okay. So at this time slice, when the black hole horizon size is order of LC, by this time you have a very long funnel inside this horizon, and then the depths of this funnel is given by this expression, where n is the black hole initial black hole mass, and this is Planck scale, and this is the scale at which the effective theory, local effective theory breaks down. And if you count, and then according to the effective theory, this the collective mode has an order of 1 over n fluctuation. And if you count the number of field theory modes which have order of 1 over n fluctuation, then you have this many modes available inside the horizon. And it's large because this is a long, okay? And then these are all color singlet mode, which can support the entanglement with Hawking radiation, early Hawking radiation outside the horizon.
Yeah, this looks like a remnant. You're saying that you can have a cutoff scale black hole, which has enough singlet degrees of freedom to maintain, you know, to change all the outgoing Hawking radiation, to be correlated with all the outgoing Hawking radiation.
Right.
And so that would normally lead one to say that this cutoff scale black hole can't evaporate very quickly. It can't completely disappear because it has to somehow emit all these very long wavelength modes inside. And it will be, therefore, around a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
Which is bad for other reasons.
Which is bad. And I think Carlo Rovelli has proposals which lead to different arguments completely, but lead to the same final.
Yeah, so I don't. Yeah, I don't know about the precise fate of this state at later time, but does this assume that you are in equilibrium?
No, no, you're out of equilibrium because the black hole's been evaporated.
But at least region inside the horizon, is it?
I don't think there's any assumption. Just as long as you have a lot of degrees of freedom left, and they have to come out. You only have a little bit of energy to spend, and you have a lot of information to get out.
But can one consider a possibility where, say, you create some kind of disconnected baby universe inside the horizon that remains entangled with outside Hawking radiation in principle? Right? That is not excluded, right?
It's not what ADS-CFT says what happens, right? In ADS-CFT, we believe black holes can form and evaporate, and the dual field theory unitarily evolves the whole thing. And so you're not missing. If a baby universe breaks off, then the space-time that's left connected with the asymptotic region would not be in a pure state anymore.
Yeah, so I think, yeah, so this is just a scenario. This is one possible scenario that I think it is possible within this framework. That's the color entanglement.
The color entanglement.
Right. But singular entanglement is
can be
volume law.
Yes. Okay.
And what I'm saying is that the entanglement with Hawking radiation can be encoded in those singular degrees of freedom inside the horizon. I'm not saying this is prediction. It's just I'm saying this as one possible consistent scenario within this framework. And
so as just described, it suggests one of two things. Either this throat sticks around and it's a remnant, and then there's a problem basically of sort of infinite production of those or unsuppressed production of those in other processes. Or it branches off, and that means that the theory in our region is
So about the first point, I'm not sure whether this necessarily means infinite production rate, because the matrix elements between this state with a state without this long funnel for any local operator is exponentially small with this volume. Because but you, by even though you pair produce, you start with a state without this funnel, right?
These little things because they carry along these long necks.
Yeah.
And when we discuss it, people say, oh, that can't happen. It's a violation of effective field theory. It only depends on stuff outside. But it looks like you have a model in which it actually will depend on everything along this.
Mm. So I think from the point of view of the metafield, this is like a dynamical localization where, because in a sense, under the time evolution, both state and Hamiltonian evolves. And as a state evolve to a state where, say, the entanglement between inside of the horizon and outside become weaker and weaker, that means the Hamiltonian evolves to a Hamiltonian where coupling inside and outside the horizon is very weak, so that they essentially decouple from the outside, except through this narrow funnel. Okay. And furthermore, this suggests that maybe this region inside the horizon is far from equilibrium. But again, this is not a definite prediction. This is just one, I think, possibility within this framework.
But the story is again very different than what happens in ADS-CFT, where the black hole appears to give the density of space in the field theory, and there's no room for a large additional entropy beyond what we're calling the color difference of freedom.
I mean, there's no there's no large singular degrees of freedom.
Yeah, if you have a large black hole,
right,
in ADS space, you know the mechanism called entropy matches the density of states, the dual field theory. And since there's no room for an additional large entropy from a single sector.
Ah, you mean if you count the number of states?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a very different setup.
Yeah. In this case, somehow you need some states to keep the entanglement with the Hawking radiation. And it seems that this is the singular states are in principle the one that carry the entanglement with Hawking radiation. Okay, so let me summarize. So I guess the punchline is that in principle you can engineer the Hamiltonian for the matter field, which realize the gravity, but that Hamiltonian is non-local, but it has a sense of relative locality, where the strength of interaction between the two points depends on the states. Okay, and then within this framework, maybe the time arises as a Goldstone mode of spontaneous breaking of the Hamiltonian constraint, and it is possible, in principle, that this this singularity with freedom can keep the entanglement with the early Hawking radiation. Okay. Okay, and then there are some questions that I find interesting, and one question is whether there is a Hamiltonian density that obeys the this d plus one dimensional hypersurface embedding algebra at the quantum level. I think this still remains an open question, and I don't know how to pick initial state. You know, why classical semi-classical states are preferable to most general state, and also it will be interesting to extend the setup such that you allow the event where topology of the space can change. Probably this requires introducing more degrees freedom than just the metric degree freedom. And whether there's any implication for the measurement problem is an interesting question, but I don't know the answer. Thank you for your attention.
Is the Hamiltonian bounded below?
No.
Okay. Next question. On this next slide, as you say, there's an interesting question what determines initial state, and even not just why should it be classical, but why should it satisfy the classical
constraints? Yeah, I don't know.
And so one of the things people in numerical relativity often deal with is if you only satisfy the constraints approximately, the constraint violating modes can sometimes grow exponentially. So that even though formally it will be true that a leading order in large N, you know, a state that starts out localized on the constraint surface remains localized, in practice, the violations could grow rapidly.
So is that statement of about particular way of evolving, is partly accumulation of numerical error, right? In the numerical gravity.
No, it's really,
is it intrinsic problem?
We know that the dynamics of GR makes sense on the constraint surface. Once you're off the constraint surface, you can do various crazy things, and at least in Gaussian normal gauge that you've chosen, it can do this and have degrees of and have these directions in which the trajectories separate exponentially from the constraint surface. So I wondered if you thought about that, because that's in principle a way to experimentally test in the real world how close we are to the constraint surface in various ways. We seem to be on the constraint surface, and
Maybe you can add the constraint damping terms of the numerical relativity.
Well, a lot of it depends on what you choose to be your Hamiltonian.
I see.
Yeah, the way that numerical relativity works now is that they modify the equations to add constraint damping so that if you violate the constraints, the violation goes to zero.
A constraint is attractor, you mean?
Yeah, you add an extra sort of thing which stands out the constraint violations.
Yeah.
I think you can do that at the cost of probably some kind of locality.
He can put in any evolution he wants for gravity, and then inverse engineers what the evolution would be for the scalars.
Right.
So it would just be an even more complicated Hamiltonian problem.
Exactly.
The scalar.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. I haven't thought about growth of the constraint violation. But yeah, thank you for the comment.
But also, I mean, even in principle, I guess, where's Jim?
Oh, you're picking it.
Well, no, I was thinking of tests of whether or not GR satisfies the constraints in various senses. What do we really know?
Is there,
this is something that's been tested, but would you be making the prediction that if we actually did a quantum experiment and produced gravitons quantum mechanically, that we would then find that graviton is not really spin 2? You know, if we're doing something that's basically a classical process, it's run by the classical equations of motion, and if you start on the constraint surface, you remain on the constraint surface, so it may well be that in spiraling black holes, or you start on the constraint surface, only produce spin 2 classical radiation. But if you do a real quantum scattering, then there's no such constraint. You produce all the graviton nodes, and you're saying that in reality there is no constraint.
Right.
The graviton contains equally well spin 0, 1, 2 pieces in a quantum experiment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that is true.
I don't know if there's any way to test that now, but maybe a CMD measurement that measures the scalar tensor ratio at some point would probe it in some way.
So isn't that also true in the user idea CFT? For example, in the boundary field theory, if you say deform your metric, you know, through some local diffeomorphism, then as a field theory, there's a different field theory, right? And therefore the bulk, after bulk evolution, it will generate different bulk state. If you, so there will be some extra mode in that sense, isn't it? I think in the
dynamical mode in that sense. I mean,
I think it can be dynamical. For example, you can think about the mode generated by the diffeomorphism of this metric in the field theory, right? That's some dynamical mode of your field theory.
Maybe I'm not sure by dynamical mode of the field theory. It's a transformation of the field theory which is non-trivial.
Right, and furthermore, it will create excitation of your field theory, quantum field theory. If you deform your metric.
In some sense.
Yeah, if you deform your metric through some local diffeo, right? So it will generate some excitation here. So,
in other words, in ADS CFT, it is true on every slice that the constraint operators annihilate the wave function.
Sorry. So here at this slice, the wave function for the metric is just a delta function, right?
On every slice except the boundary.
But even, I'm not sure, because suppose we start with some definite metric here, and then you integrate out the bulk degrees freedom here in the presence of some IR cutoff here, and then this will define the wave function for the metric on this slice, right? And I think this metric does not, this wave function does not satisfy the Hamiltonian constraint, unless you integrate over the lefts.
If you haven't done any gauge fixing, it will satisfy the Hamiltonian constraint.
Yeah, so I think that's... I think it will satisfy the Hamiltonian constraint only if you integrate over all lefts here. That will kind of project to the constraints of space. But for any fixed proper length in the bulk, this wave function won't satisfy the constraint, right?
Fixed properly.
Yeah.
No, I disagree.
Suppose this, the proper distance from here is fixed to be 1,
okay,
right?
It's especially ADS-CFT, the proper length is always infinite, but there's no, there's some regulated or normal.
Yeah, so suppose we have some epsilon regulator here.
Then you define your surface in the interior in a Diffie invariant way, and as a result, the constraints will hold exactly.
But I'm not sure, because this wave function defined here at a fixed proper distance away from this UV boundary will be just given by something like this with some fixed lapse, right?
Oh, you're going to need fixed lapse, so you're going to fix not only the surface, but the coordinates on the surface by requiring that they be associated with the boundary of the surface.
So I'm fixing the proper distance, such.
Well, I mean, that may be true, but the point is, that is, of course, that I think is formally true, but it's still true that if you look at excitations in bulk and count degrees of freedom of graviton in bulk, they're exactly the spin degrees of freedom. The constraints hold in that very physical sense. Whereas in the structure you set forward, because there's always this fiducial metric and it defines the system, and the constraints don't hold exactly, then the quantum fluctuations of the metric are not exactly spent.
I'm not sure. In this bulk theory, in this theory, there's no fiduciary metric at all. So so fiduciary metric drops out in this bulk action.
Yeah.
So there's no background space that is fixed here.
Okay, but it's just a question of, do all the states satisfy the constraints or not?
Okay, so yeah, so the answer is no. The initial state can be any state.
Then the graviton can have trace degrees of freedom.
But I would say same is true in the ADS-CFT. The initial slice doesn't satisfy the wave function for the space-time metric at this initial slice. Sorry, here doesn't satisfy the Hamiltonian constraint. So if you regularize your field theory, and so if distance,
but the initial slice, the metric is not a degree of freedom at all. The metric is completely fixed.
Right, but you can deform your, you can think about field theory with a different metric, and then you can. I think the structure is not that different between this ADS-CFT and this structure.
I think my question is, if you actually go into the bulk and do an experiment, do you find that graviton has extra components or not?
So those,
in the ADS-CFT case, I think it's clear the answer is not. And so if you're claiming that in your context, again, quantum scattering experiments in the bulk only produce spin two gravitons, then I'm saying I don't see why, since you said that there are states in the Hilbert space that don't satisfy the constraints.
So again, my initial, I guess I'm saying the same thing. So in the same way that I can put my quantum field theory in ADS-CFT and in any background space-time, and there at the UV boundary, the wave function for the space-time metric can be anything. It doesn't have to satisfy any constraint, right? And it's exactly in that sense that my initial state doesn't have to satisfy the Hamiltonian constraint. Which I think is also true in the ADS-CFT. If you evolve only for some finite proper time, starting with some finite UV cutoff. So this picture is supposed to represent that. because in the large limit, in the end, here the, I mean, if this proper distance is not big, this metric is almost similar to this metric. So wave function wouldn't be that different from the wave function here.
Sorry, I don't see what fixed proper time has to do with it. You can fix the proper time and then still what integrate over the lapse.
But lapse determines the proper time, right? So if you integrate over lapse, then you're integrating over a different proper time.
Well, a related construction, you know, something that in fact I've looked at in a simple case recently, is you can have an operator of a fixed distance, fixed proper distance inside the bullet. And, you know, you can define an operator like that that commutes with the generator of the gauge transformations, namely the constraints.
Mm.
If you're doing it in a gauge invariant way, I mean, where you're fixing something based on how far it is in proper distance, you know, physical distance, you know, then that's, you know, that kind of gauge invariant statement typically respects the constraint.
But because initial state does not satisfy the constraint, the gauge invariant propagator doesn't give you the state that satisfies the constraint. That's the So another way of saying it, I guess, is that so there's some. Let's consider, say, minimum superspace cosmological case without to make the discussion simpler. And this is the lapse, and this is the Hamiltonian. And then suppose you have some wave function for, say, scale factor of cosmology and some scalar field, for example. And suppose initially this wave function did not satisfy the constraint, right? And then suppose you evolve this state for some time, for some fixed proper time, which is this one, right? And then if this is finite, for some fixed time, this resulting state does not satisfy the constraint either. Only if you integrate over lapse, then effectively the state is projected to the constraint Hilbert space, but for a fixed lapse, it doesn't.
Let me ask a different question. At the very beginning, you picked a certain way that your field theory states will depend on the metric G hat, or this Gaussian.
Yes, right.
If you had picked some different different state, I mean, does everything go through? I mean, how much depends on this particular choice?
So, I have chosen the Gaussian just because this is easier to work with. I think in general, this is related to the issue of how many operators you have to keep in the bulk description. For example, in this case,
I essentially kept only two operators, right? One is sourced by the energy, the metric, and the other is sourced by the scalar field. And then I designed my Hamiltonian such that my Hamiltonian does not leave that very special Hilbert space. But for general Hamiltonian, the flow will leave this sub-Hilbert space. And then I have to introduce other collective variables to keep track of those flow. I think in general, you have to have infinitely many fields because in order for the flow to be closed for general Hamiltonian, then you should consider more general state than this. But I think this the fact that such Hamiltonian has to be non-local and especially relatively local is independent of the specific choice of this wave function. The specific form of the Hamiltonian depends on this, but the fact that the Hamiltonian is relatively local, I think that's a general aspect of.
Okay. Any other questions?
Okay. Just think.